I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Today's guest is Rakesh Koneru, founder and CEO of Hummingbird EV. So Hummingbird's in the electrification space, medium heavy duty space primarily. They've traditionally been a retrofit company, not a new company, around since 2015, but they've focused on and have been successful retrofitting vehicles and transitioning, making them battery electric. We're now talking about Hummingbird transitioning to becoming an OEM and why they're going about this, how they're going about it. Rakesh, as the CEO, how he's thinking about navigating this in a technically and commercially viable way. Their approach to using microfactories and what I think is a unique way in trying to have that be part of the strategy and several other things. So really fun discussion for me, getting deep. I really enjoy getting deep into the strategic aspects and what I'm able to get there with someone kind of in the ideation phase and going through this transition. So I really enjoyed it. Hope you do as too. I hope you do as well. Please enjoy this conversation with Rakesh Koneru. Today, I'm joined by Rakesh Koneru. Rakesh, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Brandon. Thanks for the invite and great to be on the podcast.
Yeah, excited to have you here. I think this is a fun topic we're going to explore here. I think you guys are approaching it in a unique way that I'm excited to dig into how you think about it and the role of Hummingbird in this sustainability push, especially in the heavier duty vehicle space. So would you mind setting the stage a bit and introducing yourself and what you are doing with Hummingbird EV?
Sure thing. So again, this is Rakesh. I'm one of the founder and the CEO at Hummingbird. We're a California-based startup and with the focus on the electrification industry in the medium and the heavy duty vehicle segment. So our focus is anywhere between a class 5 to a class 8 segment. The company itself is very well positioned from being a vertically integrated company, from batteries till the charging stations, because we believe in that vertical integration and being less dependent on suppliers, where we can provide the right solutions to different applications when it comes to the commercial vehicle space. So we focus more on the medium and the heavy duty market segment, both on-road and off-road vehicle space.
Well, can you explain a bit about the business model and kind of the strategic focus? So how have you picked the markets that you have to focus on, and how are you guys going to make money, or how are you making money?
Yeah, so I think it sort of goes back to a bit of history about how this Hummingbird venture happened for us. So we've been in the space, again in the commercial vehicle space, over 15 years now. So we have seen scale to transition from where the high voltage components did not exist about 15 years back, where we were picking components from industrial space, and we were trying to deploy vehicles for big clients like UPS and Frito-Lay and Department of Defense prior to Hummingbird. And it was very clear, during that time, I think we were more focused on the vehicle software and vehicle integration. While we were doing the deployments, one of the key things that we have learned was for the cost and the vehicles to be reliable, you need to, as a company, have a control on certain level of products so you can scale it to the different market requirements and different applications. Now, that was the whole idea on why we've sort of, started our own venture with Hummingbird about 8 years back in California. Now, with the experience that we had from day one, our focus was to, stick to our core area of expertise, which is in the class 5 to a class 8 market segment. And unfortunately, I still believe, while it's a niche market, it's very underserved in the whole electrification supply chain as of today. And not many players are taking it serious where, it's more compliance driven rather than how do you make it, a reliable and a cost effective comparing it with a diesel truck. So we just wanted to focus on how do you seamlessly, get a zero emission vehicle out there where it's an easy switch to an end user. And it's not a push from a legislative standpoint. And with that drive, we had focused primarily on building the IP for the good part of 7 years, to where we control the whole IP stack, whether it's through a hardware standpoint or a software standpoint. And we sort of are in full control to place it across different vehicle platforms. So again, electrification, zero emission in the niche market, and we're trying to achieve the scale at the cost of a diesel. That's the focus, and that's what is the driving force for us.
And so if I understand right, the focus has been on developing this modular electric, and maybe correct the words if I'm using, but the way I'm thinking about it, modular electric vehicle propulsion system that, so rather than designing a specific vehicle and focusing on one area, it's more about, okay, how do you build this core technology, this core hardware software stack that then can be applied to different use cases? Is that
there you
fair?
Go. I think you're spot on. I'll give you a quick example, if I may. When it comes to the commercial car segment, right? So it's easy to define a payload, and you can go to something like a NHTSA and pull the data in to sort of understand the average miles you can drive in a year, right? So there's already a set standard that is easy for companies to go achieve that target. But when it comes to the commercial vehicle space, batteries being heavy and trucks being heavy, the only way you achieve the range is by loading up the batteries, which is heavy. So, a lot of customers are losing the payload in that process. And when on the flip side, when we look at the conventional players, they're more focused on, a diesel mindset where, I have a fixed battery pack with a set motor that does a set amount of range or set amount of power, right? But when it comes to the commercial vehicle space, unless you have that flexibility, modularity, like you rightly said, it becomes hard not only to achieve the commercialization, but also to provide the right solutions to all the users. That's where the modularity comes in. That's where the vertical integration plays in, and that's the focus area and the push just because of that reason.
And so your customers then are the people who are deploying these fleets. So you want to sell directly to the people who own the fleet of vehicles, and you guys are then the OEM, or are you selling to the truck companies who are going to incorporate your propulsion system into an existing vehicle, base vehicle?
So as of today, we've been more of a retrofit company with, integrating our technologies into different vehicle platforms. Now that can be a tractor, which is used in an agriculture, or that can be a class A truck, which is, being driven on the road with a refrigeration system. Or it can also be you know, something like a mining vehicle, which has been one of our core fortes in technology as well, right? So we had always played in that repower space, trying to showcase the modularity of what our systems can do irrespective of the vehicle platform. Now, we as a company were in the next phase of the growth, where we're shifting our focus from being a retrofit company to being a full-scale OEM. Now, we have some very exciting, you know, chassis platform that's going to get in play over the next few months to help us out in that transition, which is going to uniquely place us compared to the competition out there. So we're, you know, think about us shifting our focus from being a repower company or a retrofit company into a full-scale OEM. And now as we shift to being a full-scale OEM, I think to answer to your later part of the question, we also have, we're also exploring a lot of revenue verticals where we do not want to stick just purely selling a truck. But the underpinning of what we do is the technology. So we want to leverage the technology and sell the platform as well for someone to white label it or someone to do it aftermarket or specialty vehicles out of the chassis platform that we will be getting in the market. And at the same time, you know, we have full capability to get into, you know, selling the powertrain vertical as by itself and getting into a truck as a service. And one of the big USP that we also have is our technology enables us to be, you know, a very uniquely placed when it comes to vehicle-to-vehicle charging. So energy as a service, truck as a service, powertrain, the chassis platform that can enable anyone to use it for their applications, and layering it up, we intend to sell the full vehicle as a truck as well.
Yeah, maybe real quick, picking on one of the thoughts. So you mentioned that the mining industry has been good area for you. How modular is this platform? I mean, when I think mining, I first think, you know, surface mine haul trucks and huge excavators, which are massive, right? But I mean, I know there's also a lot of smaller equipment underground mine truck. Like, how big or have you scaled thus far?
So we have focused mostly on the under the mine, not over the ground, sort of vehicle space. And with that said, the biggest platform of a vehicle that we have served there, right? Like you rightly mentioned, even under the ground, there are different types of vehicles. There's about 7 different models that we play with. And the biggest size that we deal with is about a 25 tonner. So it can be a dump, sort of a coal version of, a vehicle that brings minerals in and out of mine. It can be a passenger mover to move the workers in and out of mine. It can be an excavator which has a PTO application, which again works inside of the mine. So it's about 7 to 8 vehicle platforms that we deal with when it comes to the mining.
And how? So if I understand right, it seems like the kind of core value, part of the core value proposition is that this, I don't know, say there's a company operating a mine, they want to electrify some of their fleet. There are existing options out there that have some familiarity with for electrified underground mine equipment. But I guess if I understand kind of the story here, it's that, well, yes, but those aren't optimized for exactly what your customer needs and when they need it. So what you guys are doing is providing a right-sized, optimized solution for them. Is that accurate? Could you expand on that?
Yes. So our whole approach, Brandon, is to be modular, right? And the reason why we intend to be that is when we look at an application, we sort of try to get to know the whole application as a whole. For example, if we're exploring an e-commerce application, we work with the customer and we sort of define the use cases based on the most miles driven and the use of the vehicles and the tonnage and the payload. We sort of try to understand the whole operational game of how they use the diesel trucks today. And then we sit back and, we start plugging in our systems to enable them to achieve the required range or the power levels. Right now, that can be a bigger battery, a smaller battery, a bigger motor, an all-wheel drive, a rear-wheel drive, something that has a unique vehicle-to-vehicle part of it, a fast onboard charger or a DC charger. You know, it can be any different iteration of it, right? So for us, our bill of material is about, when you look at the BOM at a very high level, we are around 75%. You know, we use the same components. Now, it doesn't really matter if it's on the vehicle, and sorry, on the road, off the road, if it's a mining vehicle. It's just for us, it's mostly the packaging that changes, but the you know, the core of the technology, the brain and the heart of what constitutes is always constant. So it's almost like a Lego block where we add a piece or a delete a piece based on application demand.
Yeah, how do you deal with then the range of boundary conditions? So like just looking at these two examples we've talked about of e-commerce, which is I think a pretty generous use case, and it's relatively low speeds, you're flat or you're on road, versus underground mine truck that is rockier, it gets hot down there, thermal dissipation is it's tough, NVH is probably more challenging. So how do you deal with, when you're designing modularity, how do you deal with, without over designing the system, also being able to accommodate these different boundary conditions?
For us, it's more about, like you rightly said, right? Like one analogy is when you look at a mining vehicle, they need high torque, low speed. But when you need something like an on-the-highway truck, it's a high-speed, low torque, right? Once you get to a cruising speed, torque doesn't have much to play with. It's only the speed, right? So the modularity is very key again over there, because what we have is you know, the power electronics that can that can take in any type of a motor. For example, when you look at speeds in general, we deal with motors that has high speed, low torque, low speed, high torque, with the same power electronics, right? Now for us, it's more software driven, where how do you tune the motor to a particular application at a particular speed with a particular torque? That's how you know, that's how we enable things to get to the different use cases. Now, when it comes to specifically about something like environmental conditions, like you've mentioned, you know, humidity has a huge role to play, and the thermal is definitely a big part of it to play. But that's where, you know, we also control the packaging aspect of it, right? So earlier I've mentioned about, you know, the bill of material being constant, and we play with packaging. Now, that's precisely where we sort of try to understand the operational conditions, whether it's temperature, altitude, speed, load, and we sort of you know, tweak the packaging to enable different load conditions.
And this question is going to get outside of my ex area of knowledge pretty quickly here, but just want to throw something out there based on something you said. So the power electronics question is interesting as well, and have some familiarity in the past with more higher speed. And as I recall, a couple of years ago, a lot of focus on switching to silicon carbide inverters with higher switching speeds to accommodate higher motor speeds for higher efficiency for most part on road. Do you need and that's a more expensive technology for the most part, I believe. Do you need that same level of hardware sophistication for a high torque, low speed, or do you end up having an over engineered solution for some of your applications?
See, to us, I think unless you're building a race car today, there is no specific need for you to, you know, for you to go in that silicon carbide route, right? So unless you're getting into extreme environments, you know, or you know, a lot of it has to also do to do with the motor that you pick, right? So if the motors are high in inductance, you might need to switch. You know, the frequency is faster, right? But I think in general, when you look at, you know, a motor that's built to be economical and that does an A to Z job, today, you do not have to specifically go with the silicon carbide route. But at the same time, there are benefits. I think, you know, we see that in the next 5 years, things will get much better with silicon carbides. Right now, we also have to be aware of the cost in the shortage that we have because of, you know, the supply chain. As of right now, I think the regular drive systems are proven. Now, can we improve on the efficiencies using the silicon carbide? Definitely, yes. But is that required today? You know, probably not. It's depending on, again, what vehicle you're trying to sell.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And then I guess jumping to the, or back to the strategy. So switching from this retrofit application to a new vehicle model. And I have a few, based on the conversation so far, a few thoughts come to mind. So one, it's hard to scale the highly customized retrofit model. Also, if you're getting into the gaps within the existing electrified options, those are slowly closing as more people are bringing electric vehicles into the market. And also, I would assume if you're able to go and if you found these gaps and these cracks, you see where there's the gaps in the markets and maybe you can go and set up shop. Like what are the things, what's been the biggest driver for you to switch and to define this new strategy of getting into vehicle builds?
Yeah, so that's actually a very good question. So there's a few things that drove us on building our own chassis platform. If I may, you know, I would go with an analogy of how the Chinese companies work, right? So now you go to a Chinese OEM, you want to buy a truck, they'll sell you a complete vehicle. You want to just buy a cab, they'll give you just the cab. You want to buy a frame, they'll just give you the frame. You want to just buy a tire, they'll give you a tire. The point I'm trying to make is their drive is more on the volumes rather than focusing on how do you control the ownership, right? But whereas when it comes to the rest of the world outside of China, they sort of believe that it's IP that they should not let go of. Right now, in that process, what happens is it sort of restricts the use cases, and it sort of restricts the market adaptability. And that's sort of what we had faced as well, where when we wanted to scale up, you know, the hindrance of getting a chassis or a frame has been very hard, right? So on the flip side, everyone in the market, all companies are building electric, right? So whether it's a big company or a new age company, it doesn't matter. Everyone's doing electric. Now, when you look at the underpinnings of how the electrification is done today by anyone, it's more of a retrofit. They haven't really looked at designing the vehicle from a ground up. The conventional chassis and the cab platforms have been built to handle a diesel version of systems. Now, that really hasn't evolved when you look at, how do you scale it up to a zero emission standpoint, right? Now, that's partly to do with, we believe it's partly to do with a lot of companies trying to stick within, delivering something to meet the compliance, but their heart and soul is really not in it, right? But when you look at the car segment, right? So, not naming anyone, I think when you look at successful car companies, they've always built a platform from a ground up. Now, the legacy players were sort of, building a retrofit, bringing into the car market and trying to sell it to the end users. And quickly they realized this, they're losing big time, right? So now everyone's focused on building their own platform centric towards electrification. Now, that shift has not happened in the commercial space. It's still a legacy system. People are just swapping a diesel with an electric version of it or a hydrogen version of it. And we think it's not the long game and how you get to the commercials the way that the states and the EPAs are pushing towards. So it's two-folded. One is we have no choice for us to get into the market other than us using our experience of 15 years and looking at a vehicle in a different perspective. And the second is we wanted to move away from the traditional conventional mindset on how a chassis is built or done.
And how does this impact your ability to be modular and customizable? So like, can you design a chassis, and do you even want to design a chassis that can be used for both of these? And I know we're just picking two of many applications that you're going after, but let's just in the mind stick with this e-commerce last mile delivery type application and the underground mine truck. do you want to build a chassis that can be applied to both of those, or is there a different level of rigidity in engineering that goes into one compared to the other?
No, our focus going ahead, Brandon, is not to get into the mining vehicle space. It's more on-road, class 5 to a class 8 segment. Now, that is our focus, and our area of focus is also more on the end mile and mid mile delivery. So the first 0 to 300 miles between charges, that is our focus. Now, the whole, you know, the whole chassis stack is very unique. And again, I cannot disclose too much at this point of time, but it's very modular. Now, when you get to see how things are built, it's a very modular frame that can adapt to different wheelbases and different configurations of setup, drive setup, including the battery setup, on the same production line. Now, that's where we are very focused on reducing the capex on building the factories as well. And big part of it is strongly supported by the whole technology stack of what we have with the chassis platform.
And yeah, maybe there's limits to what you can or can't say, but at least so far, my opinion is, like, I think you have to have hub motors and drive units at the wheels to have that level of modularity, or do you have a different opinion?
Not really. I think, see, hub motors, to the scale of the vehicles that we deal with, the technology is not there. So we still deal with the traditional permanent magnet motors, but how do we package it to the wheels is a USP for Hummingbird, where say, for example, if I'm building an all-wheel drive, the same stack that's in the front of the vehicle is going to be there in the back of the vehicle as well. So it's that modularity that we play with. Now it's just adding a motor or deleting a motor in the same sub-assembly, right? Now, when it comes to building a frame, we're moving away from, like I said, a conventional frame mindset. So it's going to be very simple, where the frames are cut on machines, on equipment, something similar to a 3D printer, which can be cut to any different sizes. Now, from that point onwards, battery is going to be part of the frame, part of the structure. And how do we enable this modularity of powertrain system to be in the front and the back with the same sub-assembly, right? So that's at a very high level, how we intend to bring it into the market.
And how do you think about supply chain robustness? So I think there's been a few examples of, maybe Proterra is an interesting example of, like, the company's relying on that pack that suddenly their business model looked a bit different, and you saw, like, Volta I've had as a past guest here, that suddenly as a direct result of Proterra's news, Volta had similar news afterward. How do you think about, while going into this design phase and building out a robust product, relying on these companies that are actually able to serve you in the volumes that you're looking at, especially early on, while also not exposing yourself to risk and tying yourself to companies that maybe aren't 100% going to be here 5 years from now?
If I understand your question correct, you're asking me how dependent are we with the competitors out there or supply chain out there?
Yeah. So I guess how do you think about, so you have, I don't know, maybe you're designing everything from the cell up, but I think assuming that you're getting some off the shelf stuff, whether it's motor, power electronics, and batteries and such, and you're packaging it in a unique way, and I think bringing it together at a systems level, the components that you choose, right, you're relying on those being supplied with timing, cost, and quality that are being discussed right now, despite the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty in the system, especially with some of the companies who are often on the younger side who are doing some of these. So, like, how do you think about that from a trade-off decision, and how to build out a supply chain that you're confident in?
No, that's actually a very good question. But again, what I meant by vertical integration is a complete control of design element of what goes on in a vehicle. Now, that doesn't stop, just on packaging. So for example, you've brought up the battery pack, right? So Hummingbird has a full stack control. Obviously, we're not producing our own cells, but we have concrete engagements with tier one OEM suppliers for the cells. Now, from cell to a pack, pack to a vehicle, is completely in control of Hummingbird. Now, we are building our own cell to a pack design when it comes to the battery. Now, when it comes to the powertrain, the same goes there. Now, you know, the only aspect of the powertrain that is out of our control today is the motor. We still depend on the motor suppliers to give us the motors. But again, that motor is specifically built as around our design requirement today. But when you look at, you know, if you look at the five-year goal of Hummingbird, we are also getting into our own motor design. And the intent is to build our own motor using a contract manufacturer in the next 2 years. So with the exception of auxiliary components like power steering, you know, AC heater, stuff like that, you know, 2 to 5 years down the line, Hummingbird is going to be positioned to be in a place where it's completely vertically integrated. Now, in that process, we may engage with contract manufacturing where we give our design to print to contract manufacturers to get us the sub-assemblies. And Hummingbird will just stay focused on building the final assembly stations, which is what the microfactory is all about, and be positioned where the customer is going to be. So we're, you know, we're trying to not build a mega factory. We're trying to not build a conventional factory that you see things happen today. Rather, it's more IP-centric, design-centric. Now, how do I take the design, go to the suppliers, and have them, you know, do contract manufacturing at a sub-assembly level? How do you pick the sub-assemblies and do a final assembly at your place? That's sort of the game. And the whole, again, the whole stack is controlled by us.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a bit more about the micro factory strategy and vision, how you see that playing out?
Yeah, so one of the big driver for us, you know, Brandon, is, you know, this sort of ties back to the failures too, that you probably see the devaluations that's happening in the market as we speak, is, you know, companies are either overestimating the demand or over, you know, promising on certain things to the customers. And in that rush, we see a lot of these big factories being built and being underutilized. And on the flip side, you know, we have a lot of geopolitical tensions, right? Now, can I take everything that I produce from US to different countries? And likewise, right? So on one side, you're building huge factories that are very underutilized. And that's partly because the tech is driven towards, you know, it can only be built unless you have that scale of a setup, right? Mm-hmm. But now, in our case, we want this to be a demand trigger. Now, the modularity and the vehicle platform enables us to build factories based on demand trigger. Now, like I was stating earlier, our focus is more where we engage with contract manufacturers and Hummingbird will have a final assembly line that is going to be positioned where the demand trigger is. Now, in that process, when you look at the whole vertical of Hummingbird, you know, within the US, we want to build small clusters of factories in the US. Over the next 10 years, we're planning about 10 factories. Now, what that does is it not only thrives local economies in different places, in different states, because states are also competing, right? California is competing with New York. New York is competing with Detroit. So everyone's looking at, you know, what's, you know, how does it benefit them, their local economies, right? So declustering this whole mega factory into small clusters of factories will enable us to be where the customer is, localizing the supply chain, reducing the transport emissions, and at the same time, you're not building one factory that needs a huge resource, which is also a resource constraint, right? So if I can decluster all of that into multiple factories, at a very low capex because of how my technology is built around. It will also enable me to stay away from the geopolitical tensions while localizing the supply chain, localizing the, you know, helping the local economies and being where the customer is. So that helps me to get into time to market very fast. So for us, each factory is about a 6 to 9 months. So whenever there is a demand trigger, each factory for us about, you know, is about 15,000 pieces a year. Now, whenever we hit that threshold, whenever there is a demand trigger, that's when we go build in, you know, a different factory in a different place where the customer is going to be. And on, you know, to add on, you know, what it helps us is also, we're not trying to build a brand new facility from the ground up. There's huge real estate that's commercially available already. Now, mm-hmm. It should be as simple as I can get into a Detroit, you know, for example, a Detroit metropolitan area. And as long as I have a warehouse of about 200,000 square feet, I should be able to get in and produce 15,000 vehicles. That's for us, in sense, where the micro factory is. And that is what enables us to get outside of the US faster as well and get into, say, for example, markets like India, where the truck cost is $40,000. Now, how do you take a $200,000 vehicle into a $40,000 market? That's where the, you know, technology stack comes in. We can, you know, diversify the investments, localize the investments, stay away from geopolitical tensions, bring in volumes, and position ourselves where the customer is going to be.
Yes, it's an interesting perspective. Maybe if I can talk through some of this, and I'm trying to make sense of myself and poke holes or help explain my thinking here. So the what I'm hearing, I guess, is that there's a risk mitigation play here. You're able to wait until you figure out where the demand is, and you're able to the core premise we've been talking about. You're able to right size your production to the market and do it when and where it makes sense, not make big bets up front before you see stuff materialize. There's also, you're designing your product specifically to be capital efficient from a assembly product. You're going to cut down on logistics, maybe be able to take more advantage of state or local incentives. You then, the added cost or the downside is you can go and lease facility. You're going to have to bring in some people to come set that up, probably hire locally. The leadership aspect is probably more challenging with distributed. From a supply chain and inventory management perspective, I think it's significantly more challenging on the back end with how you're managing flow of materials and your safety stocks and all of that. And then you have duplicated capital expenditure. So despite the fact, yeah, you're going to design a product that's going to be capital efficient, you're still going to have some tooling, fixture, equipment, facility space that you're going to be leasing that's going to be required at each of these locations. But your view, it seems, and this is where I'd appreciate your input and correct me if I'm misinterpreting, but your view is that the benefits outweigh the costs here and are going to allow you to, yeah, maybe it changes 10 years from now, but like for now, like the benefits outweigh the cost.
Yeah, the benefits definitely outweigh the, you know, some of the drawbacks that we may foresee. But again, I think what I was trying to also reiterate on, Brandon, is the aspect of contract manufacturing, right? Now, to your point on inventory management, right? So, for example, our subsystems are going to be built out of a single facility, or whether it's at our place or you know, through contract manufacturers. So it's just you know, think about group of clusters, which gets fed by one big cluster that does sub-assemblies, right? Now The small clusters are going to be just, you know, in other words, a final plug and play or a final assembly line.
So the sub-assemblies, right? So the tooling you'll be able to benefit.
You'll get
economies of scale, and those are cheaper to ship, right? Because they're smaller and lighter.
Exactly. Rather than shipping a whole vehicle that's built in Carolina back to California, right? And he's having a huge facility that drains how much amount of water, how much amount of electricity. And it's a very niche market too. Now, it's local employment, look in California, it's hard to find, the right labor to build, you know, factories and work in the factories. And it sort of outweighs, the risk aspect of it when I look at it from a global perspective.
Yeah. And I mean, despite I mean, I raise both sides just because I'm trying to work through this and be clear about the situation. Yeah. But there's a, I mean, that as well as some of the previous stuff we had talked about. Like one of the core beliefs I have is that no one really knows how fast electrification is going to scale in. And so we have projections of volumes and over time. There's variability on several axes, including regulations, technology, maturity, supply chain, consumer interest. How well, I mean, do you have big customers who have operations that they've been using forever? Like it's not simple for them to learn how to plug and play and get the charging infrastructure in place. So yes, we have projections. I don't believe any of them. And so the general idea I have, and I mean, this is the philosophy of, I mentioned the contract manufacturer that I lead up to my day job, of like, be capital efficient, pay a little bit more upfront for your piece costs, but wait as long as you can to make your big bets, because that's how you're going to kill the company, is if you place a big bet too early and it's wrong. And then also you can be more intelligent about where to place that bet as you gather more data and as this all fills up. So yeah, there's definitely some core philosophies here that I hear that align with how I think about things.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, for what it's worth, not that you came here to get my opinion at all.
No. It's always good to know, to get some validation that our thought process is not too far off from, you know, industry experts.
I mean, it's not simple by any means, right? As you talk, like the
stuff
like inventory, and I mean, even like the leadership aspect, you can't, running 10 plants is a lot harder to have good cultures and high execution than having it at one place. So like, there are challenges, but business is about trade-offs, right? So like, you have to pick where you're going.
Definitely. I think you need to localize it because, you know, Brandon, on the other side, look at it from the perspective of vehicles, right? So now when you need to get into electrification in a place like an East Coast, that's a completely different environment from West Coast, right? Now, just from purely weather perspective, right? Now that's where our ideology is a bit different. Why should the vehicle cost be the same, you know, across the place, where when you look at a conventional vehicle, they just say, okay, it's $100,000 plus shipping, right? Why should it be like that? If I can do it much smarter, much efficient, to drive economies to the requirements, we should be able to do that. And if I build it out of one facility, it will never happen.
Yeah, I guess that's a piece of the framework that I've had here that I wasn't connecting, of like, yeah, I guess theoretically you don't need to produce the same vehicle at every one of these micro, like you have the same bones, but that's where the modularity comes in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Rakesh, this has been fun. Definitely gives me some things to think about. It's cool to hear. I mean, it's always interesting to hear the journey, right? And I think also the fact that you guys have been around for some time and like have found a market, but now are going through this pivoting or kind of the next stage of the company is super interesting, because right, you have some reps under your belt, you have something that has worked, and then now you're trying to figure out like, okay, how do you future-proof yourself and how do you take advantage of the opportunities ahead. So this has been a lot of fun. Good getting your perspective. And maybe I'll give you kind of the last question, two-parter, I guess. Did we miss anything here? Anything that you were hoping to get across? Or independent of that, is there anything you want to leave anyone who's listening to this? Any thoughts, parting thoughts, stuff like that?
Yeah, I think the key takeaway that I would want to have listeners to, you know, probably, you know, hopefully getting this, you know, getting out of this whole conversation is, if electrification is the way to go, and if zero emission needs to be done at a scale, companies do need to think out of the box, traditional mindsets that fits the market requirement, so it's an easy transition to a consumer, because we strongly believe there is a demand trigger out there. It's just not been happening because, you know, the companies are not producing the right products to the right market. And that's sort of what we're trying to change. And hopefully we'll make some very good progress in that direction. One solution's not going to fit for all applications. And that's sort of what we're trying to, you know, be different with and get to market, you know, with that approach. with that said, you know, Brandon, again, thank you. Appreciate the time. It was very, it was very good to have you, and, you know, great, you know, thanks for having me as well. That's pretty much it from my end.
Cool. Well, thanks again, Rakesh. Really appreciate it. And best of luck to you and Hummingbird.
Awesome. Thank you, Brandon. Likewise. Good luck.
Well, there you have it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rakesh Kanero. So what stands out to me? I'll highlight two things. So the first is trade-offs, right? So anyone who's in business, who's in engineering, and probably other disciplines, realize that there's no free lunch out there. You make trade-offs. You try to understand a scenario, and you try to optimize for what you think is most important, which inevitably means that you're going to trade something for that. This approach that, two aspects, right, of Hummingbird's approach. One, the transition from retrofit to an OEM. You are now upping the stakes and taking on a bigger piece of the puzzle, which has a greater upside, also potentially more risk. And I think we've seen how difficult that transition is and how difficult it is to grow an electric vehicle OEM kind of across the industry. And then even the micro factory approach, really interesting, right? So on the surface, you can tell a compelling story, right, of being close to your customers and not having these huge capital investments and having flexibility. As I highlighted and we explored a bit, there's also downsides, right? Of you're duplicating capital. You're not able to get the efficiencies that if you're dealing with material management, that becomes much more complex. And if you think about just the manufacturing reality, it's much more difficult, you know, handling inventory and finished good storage amounts and a lot of different things when you are distributing your manufacturing across various facilities, as opposed to, like, there's a reason, right, that traditional automotive manufacturing has come from single plants. I'm not saying it's impossible, right? And I think Rakesh had some good feedback and thoughts to share on how they've navigated this trade-off. But I think that this is part of the reason why I enjoy this podcast so much and why I enjoy this episode, is the opportunity to have a real conversation about these types of things, right? And it's not just accepting at face value that, like, oh yeah, distributing because the traditional OEMs have been centralized, now we want to shake things up and be distributed. Like, that's interesting, but not because it's novel. It's interesting if and where there is first principle or, like, real value to be gained from the strategy. And that's often what I'm trying to uncover and what I was trying to uncover here. So I don't know, huge, huge hurdles ahead of Hummingbird, of course, as they try to scale and they have things to figure out. But I really enjoyed the discussion. I wish them best of luck. It sounds like they're approaching aspects of this in a manner that may seem to make a lot of sense. So yeah, hopefully it works out for them. As always, really appreciate you listening. There's more to come next week.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility Podcast, brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. If you have a need for a trusted manufacturing partner for low value to highly complex products, please visit us at edisonmanufacturing.com, or feel free to share your directly at brainfood.com/edison, or visit my link. Edison specializes in complex products and annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you're making an impact in the global space, you're welcome. Until next time, thank you.